So what we've been doing is just going Psalm 60 through 69 these 10 weeks. So we're on Psalm 63, week 4. It really was blowing my mind earlier because this is week 4, but we're only on Psalm 63. It took me a couple of minutes to realize that week 1 was on 0. So we're counting 0 to 9, not 1 through 10. It was a rough go. Man, so before we get into the Psalm 60s, let's talk about the 1960s just for a quick minute, because I think this will really set up where we are in this text today. See, the 1960s was kind of the beginning of the sexual revolution. We were promised so many things in the 1960s, right? Your life as you have known it, right? Here's the only thing I know of the 1950s is what I learned on Leave It to Beaver and the Donna Reed Show, right? So my understanding of the 1950s comes from that, right? So even the worst kid in town, Eddie Haskell, is still a really good kid, right? So then we come into the 1960s and they tell you, man, everything that you've been experiencing is only part of what you could experience. Life actually exists at a better level. So what you need to do is forget this whole monogamy thing. That is ancient. That is, ugh. What you need to do is experience as much as you can, as often as you can, and you will be satisfied. Right until it's over, and then you leaves you wanting more, right? Or, hey, you know what, guys? These walls, they're white. If you just take this little bitty thing, your walls, they'll start to melt, they'll start to turn colors. That little friend that you had, that imaginary friend that you had when you were a kid who looked like a little boy, man, you take this little thing and it will turn into a dragon, and you will have the most fascinating, most colorful conversations you can. And not only will you be having fascinating, colorful conversations, but you will be speaking with a dragon. That's what your life's missing. You need to have your mind open. You need more. You need better. Or rock and roll, or, you know, right? Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That's what you need to satisfy you. Fast forward to here we are today, 2015. And really, as far as satisfaction is concerned, it's not gotten much better. We're still told monogamy is an ancient thought. Promiscuity, going out there and finding it where you can and getting it as often as you can, is the answer. It'll make you feel better about yourself. It'll make you feel better about life. Get as much money as you can. Work as hard as you can. You'll be satisfied. These pills, these drinks, they will satisfy you. Back then, we just had pills and drinks that satisfied us, and we were kind of self-medicating, right? Today, we can actually go to the pharmacy and actually be doctors. Pastor Jay and I were talking about this earlier. You can be medicated by a doctor, which, that's good. Medicate, self-medicated, good. Medicated from a doctor, good. Put them together, better, right? Because we are in a constant pursuit. We are terminal. We will bear down this gun right to the point of death, trying to satisfy ourselves. Which leads us to Psalm 63, and it just simply starts with this phrase, "My soul thirsts for you." You read that and you think to yourself, what in the world is a soul? Like, I keep hearing this, I keep coming to church, and I keep hearing my soul is thirsty, right? But I don't know where a soul is. I know where my toe is, and I know where my kneecap is. And last Saturday morning while I was running a lot, I could not have been more aware of where my left calf was, right? I ran for about 4 miles. I had 9 miles to go until I could see the finish line, which, by the way, they told me I was only running 13.1 miles, but my GPS told me I ran 13.56. So I'm going to go ahead and count that as running a whole marathon, not just half. I ran past the half, so we're going to count that as a whole. Right, but I could not have been more aware of where my calf was because it had a big old cramp in it. And for 9 miles, I ran not being able to fire off on my calf because I felt like it was going to rip in half. I was aware of that, but where's my soul? What is a soul? Scripture makes it clear that you and I are made up of two parts, One part is our body, and the other part uses two words. Sometimes it calls it a spirit, sometimes it calls it a soul. Your body, this is the sin you. This is the broken you. This is the you that Adam and Eve, when they sinned, broke. The soul you is the place that is empty, that is void, until the point where Jesus comes in and fills it up with himself. And that's the place where he takes up residence, where he begins to change the way that you think, where he begins to change the way that you live. And David is saying, this innermost part of me, this part of me that is filled up with you, God, is thirsty for more of you, God. My soul thirsts for you. So let's read this together. Psalm 63. If you have a pew Bible, it'll be on page 479. If you have a screen Bible, it'll be on screen left or screen right. And if you have my Bible, it'll be right here. But you don't have mine. I do. Ready? It says, God, you are my God. Earnestly, I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you. As in a dry and weary land where there is no water, so I have looked upon you in the sanctuary, beholding your power and glory, because your steadfast love is better than life. My lips will praise you, so I will bless you as long as I live. In your name I will lift up my hands. My soul will be satisfied. My soul will be satisfied. Remember, we're told we can find satisfaction anywhere and everywhere, but that is just satisfaction for our flesh. The problem with our flesh is that our flesh is never satisfied, and so it is satisfied, and then it is thirsty immediately. My soul will be satisfied as with rich, fat food, and my mouth will praise you with joyful lips when I remember you upon my bed and meditate on you in the watches of the night, for you have been my help. And in the shadow of your wings, I will sing for joy. My soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me. But for those who seek to destroy my life, you shall go down into the depths of the earth. They shall go down into the depths of the earth. They shall be given over to the power of the sword. They shall be a portion for jackals. Take a little time out. I'll tell you what you got. Tell you guys what I've learned. Recently, they changed the midday show on ESPN Radio. And every Tuesday, there is a wildlife expert who calls in, and then you can ask him any question you want to, and he will know the answer, right? So one of the questions was, this guy called in and said, who would win in a fight? A wolf or a hyena or a jackal? Who would win in a fight? I'm driving along thinking, okay, who? Can't wait for the answer, but who cares, right? Please tell me why I care. So then he tells me, he says, you know, wolves are smarter. Wolves are faster. But you see, hyenas and jackals are more fierce. Their jaw, the strength of their jaw, could rip apart elephant flesh from bone and then rip apart elephant bone down to the marrow, the part that tastes the best. Like, okay, how many of you, when eating a Reese's peanut butter cup, push out the center of the chocolate? Or Oreos, you split it in half and lick the cream, right? You just get straight to the part you want. Like, leave the cookie part. I just want the cream filling. Which, by the way, if you're dairy-free, Oreos are your cookie. Good luck with the rest of your life, because that's all you get to eat. But that's what they can do. They can rip apart and get to the part they really want. So in his opinion, in his expert opinion, a jackal would win in a fight because of the strength of their jaw. Because if they can get that bite down, the wolf may be faster and smarter, but if that jackal can land that one bite, it will be terminal. Also, think in a historical context. To be left for jackal food means that you weren't buried. It means that you didn't have a homeland. It means you didn't have a country. It meant that you were left out in the wilderness to be devoured by wild animals. Right? So those who oppose me, God, those who oppose me, those who are after me, and they're going to go down. They're going to be left out in the desert, no home, no burial, and they will be devoured by fierce, wild animals. But I, and then he keeps going, but the king shall rejoice in God. All who swear by him shall exalt, for the mouths of liars will be stopped. What we usually do is just kind of read through this, and then we go back through and take it apart and see what we can understand. But as I was sitting in a coffee shop this week, I'm reading through this, thinking, and I get about halfway through, and my mind shifts from my typical way of looking at the text and thinking through it, and I start to see it on the opposite side. And I'm sitting in the back corner of a coffee shop, and I'm just crying. Like I lean over towards the window, and I'm trying to get the sun in my face so it looks like I'm not crying, guys. It's just the sun in my face, but I'm wrecked. I am broken over what I'm seeing. And so I'm glad that you're all here today, because it's time that we stage an intervention. It's time that we intervene, because it is impossible for me to preach this text to you until this text preaches me. And I cannot, with great truth, tell you that this psalm is a reflection of my own heart. I'd love to tell you that it is. I'd love to stand here as your bright shining example, as Jesus is my bright shining example, and lead you to the way that you can be made whole. But today I stand here as one in need of help, as one in need of you. And so I bring this to you this way because maybe I'm just not alone. And so I'm going to say you, and I'm going to say we, because it makes me feel a lot better if I'm not alone. But what you need to know is that when I say you, or when I say we, I mean you, and I mean me. All right, so our typical view would be that I would read through it, and I would look at these first three verses, and I would talk about God. I would talk about who is God, because he begins by saying, "O God, you are my God," right? So over Israel surrounded by a bunch of different countries, all of these different countries have their own God. And David is saying, "Listen, God, all of these gods fail me. They leave me wanting you. You are my God. You're the God that I'm after. I'm not after the God of Philistia. I'm not after the God of Ephraim. I'm not after the God of Syria, Babylon. I am after you, God." And so who is this God? And so he continues on. You could throw up the list. He says, "O God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you." Last Saturday morning when I was running, I understood desperately what thirst was. I knew when I saw the water table, there was a little giddy up in my step. I felt more energy in life because I knew that what I needed was about to be provided for me. He's saying, "God, you are satisfying." He says, "My flesh faints for you." Think back to where God created everything, because that's what he's saying. You, God, the creator of everything, you're my God. You created me. You formed my flesh out of the dirt. You breathed your own breath into my lungs, and that flesh cries out for more of your hand, and it cries out for more of your breath. My flesh is crying because you, God, not only do you satisfy, but you are the only source of life. And so God is life-giving. He says, "I've looked upon you in the sanctuary." Sanctuary, we see right now people fleeing over in the Middle East, fleeing for their life, leaving, heading into Europe where they can find sanctuary, where they can find refuge. Because in their own homeland, they are being hunted down and killed. In their own homeland, there is no peace. There is no rest. But God, I have looked upon you in the sanctuary. So God, you satisfy. You give life. You provide peace and rest for my troubled soul. And when I get to experience that peace and that rest, I really get to understand your power and your glory. And so God is satisfying. God is life-giving. He is peace and rest. He is powerful and he is glorious. And that is who God is. So then I start to wonder, man, if that's who God is, why do I find myself so often relating to God by what he does. Like, God is good when he fill in the blank. We've all known someone who's gotten sick. Maybe it's cancer, maybe it's something else. And we all come to God. My church back home in Texas was on this list at the Baptist hospital that if you needed a pastor to come pray for somebody, just call our church and we'll send someone out. And so we took turns. We were all on a week, so there were 12 of us, so we only had to do it once every 12 weeks, right? So I get to the hospital and I said, hey, did somebody call for a pastor? And this guy, he goes, Mama, preacher's here. And I was like, where? I'm just the happy, fun time music guy, but you probably don't want to know that. So, yep, preacher's here. Hold on. Forgot. I got to stretch. I got to get ready for this. Oh. So, trying to be sensitive to the needs, I said, you know, just at the most surface level, I'm not trying to get into your business. I'm not trying to figure out what's going on. If you could just tell me kind of just the basics of what's going on so that I know how to pray. So, well, Mama is this. I mean, Mama was like 98 years old, just so we're clear. I walk over and I put my hand and I look down and Mama's 98 years old. Nice life, right? So he starts telling me what's going on with Mama. And so we want you to pray that God would heal her and she would live a nice long life. And I look down again and I'm like, wait, what? Okay. So we want you to pray that God would heal her because we believe that God is good. And because God is good, he's going to heal Mama and she's going to live a nice long life. And I just think to myself. And then I talk with people who have a loved one or they themselves have cancer, and I believe that God is good, and I believe that God heals, and I want him to show himself off as good. And I can't help but think your healing has zero bearing on God being good. Live or die, rich or poor, God is good. Which leads me to this question, why do I so often relate to God? Because of what he does. I don't relate to my wife because of what she does. I love her for who she is. What she is shown by what she does. But it doesn't prove. So read this with me, because this is the question that I was just slapped in the face with. There's a massive difference between being captivated by someone, what someone can do, and being captivated by someone. Like, it's playoff baseball time. I've been watching the Chicago Cubs all year long. I had to turn the TV off last night because I knew I was going to meet with some of you people who might be stinking Mets fans. Right, and it was 4-2, and the Mets were winning. And I didn't want to know before I got here because I didn't want to be bitter standing up here because there's nothing worse than a bitter guy speaking into a microphone over a bunch of joyful people, right? So I turned it off. I can't know how this ends. If you know, don't tell me till after. But you see, my attention all season long has been captivated by the Chicago Cubs team. They're not supposed to be this good yet. There are 8 positions on the field that play regularly, and then there's a pitcher who rotates in. 8 positions, 4 of them are held by rookies, guys who have never played in the big leagues before. In the last series, at least one of those rookies, hit a home run every single game. 1 game, 3 of them did it. And I am captivated by these guys, which transports me back in time to the 80s when my fascination with the Chicago Cubs was birthed. And I was captivated by Sean Dunston and Ryne Sandberg and Mark Grace and Andre Dawson and down the list. When I was a kid, I wore number 23, not because Michael Jordan wore number 23, but because Ryan Sandberg wore number 23. I desperately wanted to grow up to be just like him. I was captivated by these people, just like I am by these guys. But I know nothing of them off that baseball field. I know their statistics. I know. But I don't know if they're married or single. I don't know if they're nice or mean. I don't know if they have kids or not. I know nothing of them. But I am captivated by them. This kid, Kyle Schwarber, he's a catcher. But the Cubs have a really good catcher. But Kyle Schwarber's too good of a hitter. We got to get him in the lineup somewhere, so let's put him in the outfield. Right? What do we know about people who play catcher? They're usually bulkier, right? They're usually more stout. But this guy is out there running in the outfield like he is. Thin and quick, and he's catching these balls like he belongs there, like he's been playing out there his whole life. This last series, he does things that can only be compared to what Babe Ruth did. Like his numbers in that last playoff series, I'm captivated by these people. But it's only by what they do, not by them as a person. And I'm terrified that that's what we do to God. We're captivated by the things that he can do. If I do this, then God will do that. And when I go here, God will move there. And if then, and so we've turned God into this grand if-then statement. Like these lights that change colors in the ceilings. They have a setting where you can do a whole app that's called if-then, if-this-then-that. Right? So if we were so inclined, we could set it so that every time the Dallas Cowboys scored a touchdown, the lights would turn blue. And then they would go back to where they were. It wouldn't happen very often this season, but you get the point, right? But we've turned God into this grand if-then statement. If this, then that. And so I have to this so that God will that. Listen to this. God is that no matter what your this is. But you see, we've turned him into this thing. We have no clue. Not only do we not know where our soul is, but we have no idea how to be satisfied in him. Because we think that we hold the strings. We've turned God into this grand puppet show. And remember, the we and you is me. If I do this, then God will do that. If I go here, then God will do that. And we want this, so it means I have to this. And here I am, captivated, motivated. All of this by what God does. And it all comes down to the fact that we have no idea who God is. It's not hard. He told us. He did us a favor and wrote it down. You see, I'll go through times where things are good and I'm in this thing like I need it. Right up to the point where things are going about like I wanted them to go. All right, God, thanks. You can take a break over there on the bench. Got this for a little while. Nope, hold on. Back in the game a little bit. Got a cramp in my calf. But David, running for his life, being chased down by his son. The reason why this stirs for me is because David, in his fleeing, was led out into that desert, outside of the promised land. But you see, David's not so different from me. I was sitting down with Ed and Donna the other night, and we were talking about how God didn't tell David to run. David told David to run. Because David, in that moment, said, I got this, God. I'll just run away for a little while. My son will forget that he's mad at me. My son will forget all about wanting to be king. And he'll remember that I'm the king, and it'll be all good. I just have to run long enough, right? I used to tell people that if you and I were about to get in a fight, there's no way I'm running. Because you're eventually going to catch me, and then you're going to beat me up, and I'm tired. I'll just go with one, right? Just beat me up, right? So here's David running through the desert. My son can't catch me. Son can't catch me. I got a 10-year-old son. I know what it's like for your son not to be able to catch you, except for his son wasn't 10, right? So, well, my son's getting closer. My son's getting closer. And all of this is based in these two lies. There are two lies that base all of this. One, the first truth is we don't know who God is. And two lies that keep us from actually knowing who God is. The first one is, we don't believe that we're good enough. The problem with that lie is that it is 100% true. The best lies are the ones that have shades of truth, and this is the best lie of them all because it is completely true. Right? If you can tell a lie that's got lots of parts of truth, it's believable, it's plausible, we're good to go. This one, 100% true. You are not good enough. There's an entire book designed to let you know you aren't good enough, centered around the fact that Jesus is. Right? So it's not a book that tells you you're not good enough. It's a book that tells you who is good enough for you. But here I am thinking, oh, you know what? I hear you, Pastor. Jesus is good enough, but I got to come up to the level to deserve good enough, right? There's a point where I can let Jesus take over and become good enough, but I got to get myself up to that point. I'm not, because I've been and I've done. And sometimes I'm still doing. I got to earn the right for Jesus to be good enough. That's that lie. Same lie that the serpent told Adam and Eve, right? You're not good enough. God doesn't want you to eat from that tree because he doesn't want you to be good enough. He's trying to keep good enough away from you. He knows that if you eat from that, you'll be satisfied. And he wants you to be satisfied in him. You see, those lies that come with shades of truth, he does want you to be satisfied in him, but he's not trying to keep you from being satisfied in yourself. He's trying to protect you from being satisfied in yourself. So now the lie is you just don't deserve it yet. You'll deserve it one day. Keep plugging away. Keep trying. Keep working. You'll get there. All the while, we just kind of take a couple of steps back, and because I don't deserve it, I won't relate to God for who he is. I'll just relate to him for what he does. And if that's not bad enough, there's a worse lie. The second lie is that we don't believe that we need God. If I took one of my famous, everyone loves it, straw polls around this room. All right, if you don't think you need God, raise your hand. As I suspected, no one raised their hand. But we live functionally as though we don't need him, right? He's the end of the bench. All right, Jesus, down by one, got a runner on. Did you get up there and pinch hit? This is my biggest mode of operation. God, I got this. Got this with the church. I'll let you know when I need your help. I got this with my kids. They're just 10, 11, and younger. I got this. I'll let you know when they're teenagers, right? Right now, they don't like boys and girls. We're good. I got it. When they start liking each other, I'm going to need a little help. But for now, I'll teach them about you. I'll teach them to love you, and I'll teach them what I know of you, and I'll invite you in when I need you. Right? Functionally, I don't need him. And I told you guys this all year long. I've been telling you. We started the book of Ephesians, first week of the year. Finding our identity in just simply what Jesus has done for us. Versus what we do or what people think of us. What we might become or what's ever happened to us. Or, God forbid, I find my identity, my self-worth, and the things I've got. But here I am, knowing what the problem is. I know that I am satisfied with myself, all the while being dissatisfied with myself, because my identity is wrapped up in, packaged in, shipped by, delivered by, opened for you by, used for you by my ability to do stuff. And why is that? Because I'm really good at doing stuff. Like, I've never really in my life experienced a great level of failure. Never. Everything I've ever tried to do, I have had a relative amount of success. One, because I'm careful to weigh the cost, and if I can't succeed, right? So when I was in the ninth grade, the baseball coach told me I'd never be a baseball player. I was too small. All right. I guess the small guys sing in the choir. So I'll go over here. Right? Then I get to college and I think, you know what? My dad seems to really prefer my brother over me. And my brother plays baseball. And I'm pretty sure I'm better at it than he is. So watch this, Dad. Where's my bat? And where's my glove? Is it? There it is. My bed was uneven, so I was holding it up. Right? Watch this, Dad. So 400 guys go out to the walk-on baseball tryout. And four guys stand victorious at the end. I didn't grow one inch, but here I am because I'm good at getting things done. And I know what I'm good at. And I'm confident in my ability to get things done. Even here at church, even at home with my kids. God, I'll let you know if I need you. God is standing over there saying, your definition of success is woefully inadequate. And your definition of success is potentially backwards. Because what I look at and see as success, you would deem failure. Because I just want you to know me. And that's why he inspired James to write in chapter 4, verse 8, draw near to me, and I'll draw near to you. Not draw near to the things that I do, but draw near to me. Know me. What would my relationship with my wife be like if I only related to her for what she did? What would my relationship with my wife be like if I truly believed that I wasn't good enough for her? What would my relationship with my wife be like if I didn't think I needed her? And what would that mean for my kids? You see, we live in a culture that is broken beyond repair. Playboy has recently released news that they are no longer going to put nudity in their magazines. Not because they have come to some grand moral epiphany. They are just now a victim of a culture they created. Because if you go read the statement, they'll say, it is no longer profitable for us to continue doing business as usual. Because at a certain point, if you wanted to consume that kind of material, you had to let the world know by driving down to the store, putting it on the counter, and paying for it with money. But now you could sit at home in private, in secrecy. Culture around us tells us that satisfaction is yours for the taking, and it can be taken anywhere you want. It doesn't have to be taken with your wife, it can be taken with his. And that's because we don't know who God is. We show up all over this planet, people are showing up today. They're going to lift their hands up in song. They're going to put money into that box saying, God, we believe you're the first and the best, and you deserve the first and the best. All the while having no idea who he really is, what he really thinks, because we're not devoted to him. We're devoted to him for an hour and a half on Sunday mornings. So I'm going to say my favorite phrase, if this is the sum total of your interaction with this book, just stop coming. Because it'll never be enough. If you don't believe me, try eating one meal and then go for an entire week without eating again. And let me know what your body tells you about food. And so I need you, because I'm a miserable failure by birth, but I am a tremendous success by second birth. I have to stop trying to live in that first birth. The birth that says that I can do because I'm good. And I need to live in that second birth that says I can do because Jesus is good. He's the only thing that matters. The only thing that God ever did that's worth relating to him because of is the only thing that made it possible for you to relate to him in the first place. You had no ability to relate to God until Jesus' cross screamed across time and space. And God said, come to me. I love you. Come to me. I want you. Come to me. You're mine. Don't just come to me for an hour and a half on Sunday, but come to me regularly, continually. Come to me always. I'm here. Not for you to use, but for you to know. Know me. And make me known. Which is why church has been centered around this idea that the chief end of man is to enjoy God and glorify him forever. But you can't enjoy what you don't know. You guys remember back in the 80s when Coke came out with New Coke? It said Coke and above it it said enjoy. Right? No one enjoyed Coke. The New Coke, right? Why? Because it wasn't regular Coke. But we are trying to shove our stomachs full of new Coke that is a cheap imitation of the real thing. Why? No one likes Sweet and Low. They don't. People put Sweet and Low packets down there for those of you who like Sweet and Low, right? It's just because you don't want the added things that sugar gives you, right? Stop settling for a cheap imitation and let your song every day be, oh God, my God, earnestly I seek you, my soul thirsts for you. Like a dry and weary land. Like Psalm 42 that says, just like a deer pants for streams of water. Pants. Not just a deer who thinks, man, kind of bored, need to drink. But a deer who's desperate. A deer who's been running for its life. Who stops down and says, I can be satisfied. My life can be given. I can find peace and rest, and I can know the glory and the power of God. My soul will be satisfied with you as with rich food. So we wrap our time up the same way every week. Bow our heads and closing our eyes. This is not weird. Nobody's going to touch you or do anything weird to you. This is just an opportunity for you to interact with what you've just heard. Because I really believe that God is speaking through a megaphone at us this morning. God's voice sounds like a lot of things. Sometimes it's that still small whisper. And sometimes He speaks in hurricanes and earthquakes. And I really believe that God is screaming out through the hurricane and the earthquake this morning. Know me. Don't know the works of my hands. Know me. Come to me. And so the first question I have is, are you like me? Have you bought into one of those two lies? I bought into the one that says I don't need him. Have you bought into the one that says you're not good enough? Good news, it's completely true. You're not. But Jesus is. You just have to let him be. Or maybe you're like me and you say, I got this. I don't need you, God. He is the giver of life. And he is the sustainer of life. The author and the sustainer. Will you let him be who he is, or will you continue with your life to fight against him? It's a question that I've been answering all week long. Maybe there's someone here this morning who has no relationship with God. You're hearing for the first time that your life is completely broken and you are incapable of putting it back together. And you're hearing for the first time that the cross of Jesus, I've heard about it, I heard the stories. But you see, this Jesus stands to make you whole and he stands to make you new. And we would love nothing more than to introduce you to that this morning. So if you'd like to talk to somebody about that, be people waiting in the back of the room. Maybe you need someone to just pray with you or for you or over you or around you. They'll be in the back of the room waiting for you. God is screaming out, know me. Know me. Come to me. So we're going to sing out. It'll be another new song, and I want you to kind of just sit there for a minute. I want you to read the words on the screen. The reality that God came at the right time, born under the law, born under the woman, born of a woman, was crucified and dead and buried so that you may have the adoption of sons. This is the thing that he did so that you could know him. And then the chorus just simply says, because of that, oh praise the name of the Lord our God, oh praise his name forever. For endless days we will sing your praise, oh Lord my God. And so hear what Jesus